Because storage, if you think about it, that is the primary requirement we have. No matter what kind of computing environment, we have to store data. And then fetch the data out of the storage and look at it. Anytime, no matter what kind of thing we're doing. I mean, airline reservations, bank accounts, patient medical histories, pizza deliveries that are scheduled. This is all data, and it has to get stored in the right place at the right time so it can get fetched out at the right place and the right time as well. Right? So, the number one goal, remember, why are we in the cloud in the first place? We are in the cloud in order to scale. That's why we're in the cloud. If we only had one or two servers that could sit on the back rack, we wouldn't really care about a cloud. Right? If we went to the cloud to scale, if we didn't care about scaling, we wouldn't go to the cloud. And so whatever kind of data handling we have, it has to scale well. If it doesn't scale well, if our data handling does not scale well, then the computational scalability of the cloud will just get bottlenecked into uselessness. And then what good is that going to do anybody? So when we think about data storage in the cloud, we need to think very carefully about scalability. All right? So let me talk about the kinds of storage that there are, and then we'll talk about how they scale, and we'll talk about how they're implemented in the cloud. Now, back when I was in grade school and we studied animals, there were only two kingdoms, right? There was animals and plants. When I was in high school, there was animals, plants, and protista for things that didn't easily fit into animals and plants. By the time I got to college, the fungi had their own kingdom, the blue-green algae had their own kingdom. They were multiplying all over the place. But in storage, I am going to split storage into two main kingdoms, that of non-relational versus relational. Okay? And I'm going to talk about non-relational first. Non-relational, we saw a little bit in that previous demonstration. It has structures called things like blobs, binary large object, things like tables, things like queues. And they are non-relational, and that means that they do not enforce data integrity. And that's why they scale well. You have a blob, you put some stuff in the blob, it sits in the blob, you take it out of the blob, and you're not affecting anything else. So you don't have to lock. You don't have to follow references. It's more of a straight data copy and less following the tendrils every which way. And so that means that it scales a whole lot better, right? Now, the drawback, of course, is that whatever referential integrity your program does require is your responsibility as the application developer. You have to provide whatever referential integrity needs to happen. The idea is to design your application in such a way that you need as little as possible. All right. And then storage kingdom number two, relational. That is the familiar, classic, table-based databases. Things like Oracle, Microsoft SQL Server, Informix, if they're still in business. I mean, these are table-based classic databases. And what's good about this is it is relatively easy to program. In the sense that the database itself will enforce a lot of referential integrity. For example, suppose you have a table of orders, and in the table of orders you have a column that is a reference to a table of customers, which customer placed this order. You know, you're not going to have a separate customer information in each one, or have a separate address. You know, then with all the orders I place in Amazon.com, if they had to copy all of my data into every single one, I mean, even Amazon.com would have some trouble with it. So they don't copy the actual data. Instead, they have a reference to it. And the referential integrity means that you can't delete the customer out of the customer table as long as there is an order in the order table that refers to that customer. That is the kind of thing that a database does. And guys who study databases, as you either have or soon will, learn all these tricks and the kinds of things that databases do and that they don't. So you can have the advantage, you can have complicated queries. Get me the address of the guy that placed this order, and the database will figure it all out. It'll do joins over multiple tables. You know, it's for the scale that it's at, it's fabulous. But because it's fabulous at that scale, precisely because of this referential integrity, it is very hard to scale well, particularly to multiple machines. Because if you're deleting a customer on that machine, how do you know that there isn't an order on the other machine that refers to it? So that's why it's hard for them to scale. Now, having said that, there's a hell of a lot of data, basically all of it, that has been stored from the beginning of the universe up until now, most of it, almost all, has gone into relational databases because that's what's been there. And only now are we starting to move to scales at which this is starting to give us some trouble. So a lot of the work that you're going to be doing in the cloud is going to be relational because that's how the data is that you're looking to migrate. Anyway, that's life. So let's talk about the non-relational storage first. A blob, we call it, I always like those, stands for binary large object. And that means it is a big block of data. It's a storage of binary data. It's in a bucket. Okay, a blob is a bucket, think of it that way, that is opaque to the storage service. The storage service does not know how to look into a blob and say that, yes, this is some music and this is a picture and so on. The storage service knows nothing at all about the internal contents. And I kind of like the name blob because it illustrates that very little is known about the internal structure. It often, when you deal with blobs, it is often convenient and frequently happens that there is metadata about the blob. So think of it as a label pasted on the outside of the bucket. That's a pretty good analogy. You can say the kinds of things, the format that it's in, some naming of it, stuff like that. And the kinds of things that would go into a blob are things like a video would go well into a blob, a song would go into well into a blob, pictures. Anything where you have a lot of data and the internal structure is not very strict probably stores pretty well as a blob. All right. And so here's a diagram of the blob. You've got a storage account. That's the Windows Azure account that I have. Then you can have different blob containers. Think of that as a closet that you store these buckets in. A blob is a bucket. A blob container is a closet that contains these buckets. And you can have as many closets, containers, as you care to make. In this example, there's one called pictures, another one called movies. And then inside each closet, you can have as many of these buckets as you care to have. And a bucket is a blob with this picture, the other picture, this song, that song, the other song. You can, in some systems, Azure for one of them, you can sometimes look within a blob and you can organize a blob down to a block level. You know, blobs can be subdivided into blocks. And again, it is the responsibility of the application programmer, that is to say you, to keep track of what gets written into which block. And that's handy, like if you're playing a video and the user wants to fast forward or something or jump to halfway through, that means that you can actually random access the contents of the blob instead of requiring sequential access. So that can be nice. Some blobs go down to the block level, others do not. Still others give you the choice as to whether you will or will not go down to a block level. Alright, so that's what a blob storage looks like. And here is a common blob usage case. Suppose I have a storage service account. I call it the Song Manager Cloud Program. And there's a blob container with Mike's songs, and there will be another blob container, another closet with Bob's songs, another one with Dave's songs, etc. A closet, a container for each individual user. And then within that closet, there will be these buckets, blob number one, that has data with block number one, block number two, block number three of the song. It has metadata, a label pasted on the outside that says, you know, the title is Layla, the artist is Clapton, etc., etc. So that's the kind of thing that a blob would get used for, a very common usage case for a blob. Here, this is a somewhat less common, but I find it an interesting blob case, and it's the blob drive. A lot of the software that we want to migrate from non-cloud to cloud is used to running on a system that is used to using the file system of the computer on which it's running. And when you go into the cloud, you say, golly gee whiz, do we need to live in the file system? Because we're not really supposed to be touching the disk. Well, it would be nice if all of your data were stored in blobs and tables and whatnot. But if you have code that already is touching the file system, you say, heck, can I simulate the file system so that I don't have to change this program very much? And that's exactly what this blob drive is. You can see there is a sample in the Azure Platform SDK, the Exploring Windows Azure Storage Lab. It is in the sample code that I give you with these downloads. Basically, it takes a blob and puts a file system on top of that. So it treats the blob as if it was the actual disk. And so your programs that depend on the file system, you can plug them into Azure, and they will look at this thing, and it will appear to your program as if it were a disk drive, and it will appear to Azure as if it were a blob. And I thought that was kind of clever. If you're looking for some further investigation, I suggest you take out this sample program and step your way through it. I'm afraid we don't have time to do it in this particular sequence. Okay, what other kinds of non-relational storage can I have? Well, I could have tables, right? And now the documentation, when you talk about tables, the documentation makes a lot out of the fact that these are simply collections of name value pairs. They don't actually have an internal schema. You can use them in any way that you want. It's sort of like having a dictionary, really. You can index anything. You can index it by anything. You can use them in any convenient way, sort of like a property bag. But having said that, you will really find them most convenient in the classic case of rows and columns. So, if there's an awful lot of data that organizes in that kind of way, and they will fit well into this table structure. Now, the primary difference that you have between these non-relational tables that we use in Azure and the relational table that you're used to seeing in SQL or Oracle is that in Azure, there you don't have the automatic maintenance of the relations. So you can't automatically do a query that is the join of a table, for example, the right join and a left join, because it's not built into the storage system. You have no guarantee that these relations are maintained, but they scale a whole lot better than relational tables. So, you need to ask yourself at a certain point, golly gee whiz, how badly do I need the scalability and how much relational integrity do I actually need to provide? So, anyway, tables are the second form of non-relational storage that we frequently use in the cloud. And here's a diagram of table storage. This looks pretty familiar. There's the account, storage account that we saw before. There is a table and an entity object. I swear, there is no more ambiguous language, no more ambiguous word in the entire English language than entity. Okay? It means sort of like thing, but less specific. And the and then inside, in fact, if you read the documentation actually says, well, an entity is very similar to a row. Anyway, if you think of an entity as a row and the columns as columns, you will have about the right mental model. Think of this as a table in which relations are not enforced and which all columns are optional, and you will have about the right mental model. It's okay. So that's what a table looks like. It's about what you think. Right? And here is a common table usage case. Medical data, for example. There's the storage service. We'll call it the Health Cloud Data Service. There is a table. It's got Mike's blood pressure with a date and a time, a systolic, a diastolic, and a pulse. There's Mike's glucose with a date and a time at which it was measured, the glucose reading in millimoles per liter, etc. So that's the kind of thing that one could do with a table. Again, notice, there is lots and lots of data that is tabular in nature, by which I mean you have many, many different instances of pretty much the same collection. And, that's a table, and tables we got. All right. And the final piece of non-relational storage is the queue, and that's what we saw in the previous example. It's the classic first-in, first-out data storage structure, and you use it primarily for passing data from one computing job to another in a loosely coupled fashion. That's the key. You put data into the queue, the guys that are responsible for setting up the work get the information from the user, and then they put it into the queue a piece at a time and another piece and another piece and another piece. And the roles that are putting it into the queue really have no connection at all. They don't know, they don't especially care who is going to be taking it out or how many or at what time. Conversely, the worker roles that fetch the data out of the queue don't really know who put it in, when did they put it in, anything like that. So they aren't connected. And so it's very, very efficient. The more worker roles that you have taking these messages out of the queue and acting on them, the faster you can get the job done. If you have a lot to spend on these resources and you can get them done very quickly, if you only have enough money for a few of these things, well, they can just grind away longer. It's just like the line at the bank when you get in it. If they've got more tellers, they get everybody through more quickly. So, in general, you don't use them for long-term storage. They're meant just to line them up so they can get worked on. And as such, they scale really well. All right, so that is what those are the non-relational types of storage that we use in the cloud. And here's a diagram of the queue storage. It's pretty simple. There's the account. There's a queue. There are some messages in each one of the queues. Not a problem here. And here's the common queue usage case, which we saw before. The load balancer with the web roles. The web roles put the messages in the queues. The worker roles take the messages out of the queues. And they each operate on the storage like we had for the blobs and the thumbnails of the blobs. All right, so those are the non-relational kinds of storage. Well, now let's talk about the relational storage. These exist and will exist for the foreseeable future. It's the familiar database, Oracle, Microsoft SQL Server. Now you have a schema and the columns are strongly typed. All right, so the columns are the schema and the rows are the data. And you generally use these when relationships between the tables are necessary and when they're complicated. Any sort of web merchant is going to have a table of orders. And so an order in the table of orders will contain a reference to a product in a table of products, the key to a table of products, a reference to a customer in a table of customers, and so on. The customer may well have a reference to an address, a reference to a payment source, and you can do queries on these with one single statement. You can do all kinds of nice, fun things. Main problem is that it is really hard to scale these things very well, right? Because the one piece depends on another piece. All the pieces more or less have to see each other at the same time. And a lot of work has been done on this. How consistent do they have to be? Do they have to be consistent right away? Can they become eventually consistent? A lot of guys are doing a lot of work on just how you scale these things up. It's really nice if you can get out of it. It's really nice if you can try and use non-relational in the cloud. Now, having said that, most legacy data is in the form of relational storages, so you're really not going to lose them anytime soon. And here's the common relational usage case. There is a car table. You see there's the car key, so that's the ID of this individual car. There's the make key. That's an index in a make table that tells you if it's a Pathfinder, a Bluebird, or a Civic, or so on. The model key, and so on. There's the color. The color number one is red, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you've got, you see the relationships here. That's why they call it a relational database, right? Okay, stop me if I, get too technical here. All right. Okay. So those are the kinds of storage that we can have in the cloud. And now let's go look at what all the different vendors offer. Amazon has these things offered a la carte. You can have the simple storage service if you want. That is a blob service. You tell Amazon, I want so many blobs, and they say, fine, we will charge you X amount, and you can have this number of blobs. There is the simple DB. That is a non-relational table service of the time I've been describing. There's the simple queue, which is a queue of the non-relational type that I've been describing. And they also have a relational database service, and they call it their relational database service. All right? And if you want one of these from Amazon, you buy it with the rest of your stuff. And if you don't want it, then you don't pay for it. So, it's there. You can have what you want. And you pay for what you take. For Google, they have the Blob Store, which is a, you guessed it, blob service. Their Data Store is a table service. And then they have their Memory Cache, which is an in-memory caching service that speeds up performance at the cost of a certain amount of consistency. They do not, at the time of this writing, which is October of 2010, have a relational service currently available. I would be very surprised if we did not see one for the next year, but what the hell do I know? So Google does not have such a thing, but I imagine we'll be seeing it before too very long. Now, Azure, as you might guess, has got both. They've got non-relational, the Azure Storage Service, kind of a bad acronym there, provides blobs and tables and queues as part of your basic Azure account. And that's what I was showing you in the thumbnail example. Blob storage is what I was using then. Then, if relational is what you want, you can purchase SQL Azure, which is relational database server. I mean, that's Microsoft Azure with SQL Server behind it. The main snag with SQL Azure is it is currently, again, October of 2010, it is currently limited to 50 gigabytes, which is really not very large by current database standards. So, again, you see the problems that you get into when you try to enforce consistency over the cloud. One could reasonably argue that that when you get into the cloud, you should start thinking, golly gee whiz, how much relational data do you really need? And you know, are parts of, just as you were sort of worried about confidentiality, and you say, well, golly gee whiz, maybe there are a few things that can't be made, you know, that we can't put in the cloud, but lots and lots of stuff we can because it's efficient and cheap, so let's do that. And we'll keep the relatively small things that we really just don't trust anybody at all with, not even ourselves. We'll keep them in tight, but we can put the rest in the cloud. That works. When you look at your storage needs, you know, relational isn't going to go away anytime soon. But you might ask yourself, golly gee whiz, how much of this data here that's relational really needs to be relational, really needs to stay relational, really needs, you know, should be relational? Yes, there will be a core, but how much can be taken out and made non-relational so as to scale better? That's the question that one would start asking at this point. All right, and now I'm going to go demonstrate the blob storage and also the table storage using Azure, and that will take care of that for this. And I hope you've gotten a lot out of these lessons, and I hope I'll be seeing you sometime soon again. Thank you.
Okay, here I am, ready to continue the software demonstration, and I'm going back. This is the same thumbnails project that I showed you earlier in Chapter 2, at which time we were looking at the message queuing. But now, what we're going to be looking at is we're going to be looking at the blobs in the blobs container. We're going to be paying attention to the storage. Now, I showed it to you in the Azure MMC. I'm going to show you another way of looking at it. And there, if you go to View and pick Server Explorer, what you'll see here is there's the Windows Azure Compute Explorer, there's the Windows Azure Storage Explorer here. So I'm going to open this up. There's the Azure Storage. There's the Development Storage. That's the one that we're working on. If I open that up, there are the blobs and the tables. And right now, unfortunately, this one will not show you the queues. All right, that's it was built last summer of 2010. I imagine queues are coming sometime soon. You know, back when I was young and idealistic and stupid, I used to think that the next release of software was going to solve all my problems, right? And now that I'm old and cynical and stupid, if there's one thing I learned is it's going to, might solve this set of problems, going to give me an equal but opposite set of new problems. So anyway, so I imagine queues will come here and then we'll find something else to want, don't we all? All right, we look in the blobs here. There's the photo gallery blob that we made before. If we look here, click on those, it'll show you here's what's in there, and you can see there are the numbers, there are the files, and they're marked with a content type of image.jpg, and there they are, they're 800K and change, give or take. Then here's the thumbnails, and those are 5K and change. And if you look at this one, you can hear, there it is, it'll show you that, it recognizes a JPEG and it shows it to you. And if you look at the thumbnail, there it is, thumbnail size, etc. So you can see that this Explorer is showing us what we need to see about the blobs here in a very convenient and well-integrated kind of way. All right. So now let's go look at the thumbnails web role again. We'll go into default.aspects here. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go down to the bottom, see where it says page pre-render. All right. This comes up, and this is before the page is rendered. This is before it's shown on the screen. And let's go look at the code here. Here. Right there. Okay. Get photo gallery container. Remember, blobs live in containers, don't they? So get photo gallery container. Let's go backtrack this. Right-click, go to definition. Here in the same file, there it is, get photo gallery container. There it is. Create once container in queue, here. Go to the definition of that, create once container in queue. There. And you can see there, blob client right there, cloud blob client right there, here. First thing we do is we open our storage account. You saw that before. And now create our blob client. That means in our storage account, go create a client object that knows how to access blobs. That's what that line of code is. All right. Now here we are. Okay, Mr. Blob Client, get a reference to the container whose name is PhotoGallery. Go get me a reference to the closet whose name is PhotoGallery and give it back to me. Okay, so there I am with the container. All right. Container.create if not exist. If for some reason this container doesn't already exist, this gives me a reference to a control structure. And if the container's there, it's connected to it. But if it's not, here, created if not exists. Like so. Here I am setting the security permissions to allow public access. Anybody can access this blob container. And if we ever have a lesson on security here in the Azure cloud, we will get into more detail of it then. So right there, now at this point, I have my connection to the closet of blobs, of buckets, the closet whose name is PhotoGallery, which we saw here, right? So now I have my connection to that container. That's what I've got. All right. Okay. So coming back now to default.aspects, there's page render. Get PhotoGallery container. And now here, this is a little bit misleading. It says get directory reference thumbnails. And if you look at the PhotoGallery container here, you'll see a bunch of them, you'll see exactly four of them, half of them, start with this keyword thumbnails. Start with those strings thumbnails, and those are, you guessed it, as you can see from the size, the thumbnail. This get directory reference seems to be implying the presence of some sort of internal directory structure inside the blob container. Right? So it seems to imply a hierarchy, a folder, something like that. And in fact, if you look in the documentation here, you'll see it says get the specified virtual blob directory. You know, that's sort of the implication. But that's not true. Okay? It will behave somewhat like that. But if you look at the code, if you look inside it, if you find out what it's really doing is this is a straight name match. It says search through all the blobs, all the buckets in this container, and find me everyone that begins with that string. That's all it means. So any sort of virtual directory structure or any sort of hierarchy that you have here is solely up to the naming conventions that you yourself have provided and that this application has provided. And in fact, that's what we saw in the worker role when it creates a thumbnail. It always starts with the name thumbnail. And that's what you're seeing here. All right. So here, get me the PhotoGallery container. So that is, get me the blob container whose name is PhotoGallery. Then within that blob container, get me, please, a list of all the blobs whose names start with these. And there, give me that list, please. So now I've got an enumerator. That's what this does. It returns an enumerator of all of the blobs in that container who start with that string. It means exactly four of them, the thumbnails that have been made by the web role. I plug this into my display control as the data source and say here, data bind to that enumeration source. And that's what gets me those thumbnails up on the screen. So that's what happens every time the page is rendered. All right. Get me the container. Within the container, get me all the blobs that start with this name. Take that enumeration, stick it into the control, and tell the control to display it. That's how the thumbnails get into the display. Everybody good there? Good. Thank you. All right. So now, let's go up and look a little bit more at the submission. All right. When the user goes and puts in a reference, when the user goes and puts in a picture, what it does here, we'll come here. I'll set a breakpoint so we can go step through it. And, oh, penguins. I like penguins. All right, submit there. All right, so if the upload has a file, there it is. Get the extension from the file name here. Okay, make the name here. And so here, this is the name we're going to use for the new blob. You can see it takes the date and the time and a new GUID and takes the extension, in this case JPEG, puts it on the end. Now here, the next one, get the photo gallery container. Okay, get a reference to the blob container. Get block blob reference with name, passing that name. If you go look into this, again, this is a utility function that I wrote, not I wrote, the guy who wrote the sample wrote. If you right-click on this, go to the definition here. Here you see the name, right? It's got the time, and then a new GUID tacked on the end to make sure it's unique. Then the extension, which is the file type. In this case, it's a JPEG. Get photo gallery container, so that will give me the blob container. Now, get block blob reference, passing the name. What that will do, this is a Microsoft-supplied function, and what it will do is it will get me a reference to a blob that has that name, creating it if necessary. And look, there it is, 16, 34, 225, 79, 10, etc. We'll see that later. Okay, so now the blob has a content type, which I can set. And now the blob has a method, upload from stream. And this takes the file and puts it up into the blob. All right? And now that was pretty easy, wasn't it? Hey, get me the blob container. Hey, Mr. Container, make me a blob. Okay, Mr. Blob, swallow this data, please. And that's what it does. All right. And so that's what it looks like working with blobs. It's not real hard. The worker role does the same thing when it fetches a... the worker role does the same thing when it fetches the message out of the queue. So I don't think I'll bother showing it to you now. But that's what blobs look like. Right? Pretty simple. Okay, so that's blob storage. And I'll stop that one. There you go. And the last piece I'm going to demonstrate is table storage. And to do table storage, let me show you what I'm doing here. Here on my C drive, there's my Cloud Module V1. There. This one is in Lesson 3 storage. The previous one, by the way, was in Lesson 2. There it is, Lesson 2 and 3 thumbnail demo. Here. Lesson 3 storage. Demo and homework here. Now, I copied this right out of the Azure, Microsoft Windows Azure training kit, and documented it extensively, but it came directly out of here. So if I go into source, this one is example 01, working with tables, like this, there. And if you go to end, there, and go into C#, like so, and open the end stage project here, like this. All right. Okay, so this is a chat room application, and so you can put in my name. I think we should do this. And submit that, and it gets put in a storage and echoed down below there, and there. Like so, I'm echoing what you see at essentially any standards meeting. And the guys for about a week say to each other, I think we should do this. No, you're an idiot. We shouldn't do this. We should do that, etc. All right, so that's what it looks like. How does this work? All right. This one's a little, I won't say tricky, because I wouldn't call it tricky, but you need to pay a little more careful attention there. There are a few more moving pieces than the blob. Not too many, but some. All right. We're going to be storing data in tables. If you look at the Server Explorer here, and if you go look at the development, if you go look at tables there, here, like this, you're going to see the tables in our current Azure storage there, and there are the messages. That's what we were sending back and forth. And if you look at these, there they are. You can even see there's the partition key, a row key, a timestamp, a body. No, we shouldn't do this. I think we should do this. The name, you and me. You know, you can see that what we just typed in, you can see it's actually here, and you can look at them. It got into the Azure storage, and it exists. All right. what do we need here? Well, if we wanted to, we could do everything in a late-bound, loosely coupled kind of way by specifying quoted strings. And we could do that. It would work, but it would get very boring very quickly. Instead, because all of this data really is tabular in nature, putting it into an actual table and using some of the ADO.NET data extensions would make our lives a whole lot easier. All right, so that's what I'm going to do. The first thing that we need is we need to specify what the data is. And our data, we need two strings, a thing with a body, a string with whose name is body, another string whose name is name. And here in this file, message.cs, you can see, okay, message.cs, it has two public properties, a name and a body. It derives from this base class storage client table service entity. And again, when they say entity, they sort of mean row. Okay, don't get me started. That, by the way, is the name of my MSDN magazine column every month inside the back cover. Don't get me started. You might like it. Anyway, so I derive a class, message, derives from table service entity. I add the properties that I want to add, the name and the body, and so on. This base class, if you go look in the table here, to be stored in an Azure table, it needs to have a partition key and a row key. All right? The partition key tells Azure how to partition it for failover cases. Basically, anything that has the same partition key needs to be kept on the same partition. So that's the default case that you start with. You know, start making everything the same. And only when you get so big that you need to separate, only then do you start changing that. Right? It's an advanced topic. Can't go down that rat hole right now. But for now, what you do now is you keep them all the same. Now, this row key, this is the individual key to this individual row. And these need to be different. Okay, this is conceptually similar to the primary key that you use in a relational database, except that this table will not enforce and this storage system will not enforce its uniqueness. It is up to you to provide that uniqueness. All right. So each row key has to be unique. And then it needs to have a timestamp as well. All right. Turns out these are done by the base class. If you go look here, this base class table service entity, you can specify the partition key here. You know, the partition key is in the base class. That's where the A comes out. All right. Here, every time I instantiate a message, there's the partition key I inherit from the base class, and I'm setting it to A. That's where the A's come from. There's the row key that I'm inheriting from my table service entity base class. And every time I instantiate a message, I take the number of ticks that Windows has been running and do a little calculation on it to get a unique number and then tack a GUID on the end of it to really, really make sure it's unique and put those in. So that's where they come from. Okay, the member variables are part of the base class, but it's up to me to set them to correct value. That to be always the same, that to be always unique. And the timestamp is put in automatically by the base class. So that's where I get those. So short answer here, derive a class from this base, put on the properties that you need, and every time you instantiate one of these, set the partition key to the same value and the row key to a unique and different value. That's what I do there. All right, got that? Good. Now, let's go look at the default aspects here. All right, let's go look in the C-sharp here. When a user clicks the submit button here, what do I need to do? All right, well, I want to add a new message to the Azure table, don't I? Here I am fetching my storage account. And now here, I've got this thing called a data context. And a data context object is a mediation object, if you will. It's part of ADO.NET. It knows how to add data to a table, knows how to remove data from a table, knows how to keep track of whether the thing has been added or not, knows how to keep track of whether rows are dirty or not. It's a rather useful utility object, all right? And we need to make one of these classes as well. We need to have this message data service context object, which is over here. This message object is the actual data. This data service context is a mediation object, if you will. Again, pretty simple. If you look in here, there's not that much in it. There just really isn't. We derive our specific one from the base class, table service context. That's where the smarts live. That's the class that is smart enough to know how to add and how to remove and things of that nature. The one thing that we need to do is we need to add this property for performing a query. We say, hey, if you're going to query me, I've got a property called messages that gives you back object of class message. And so here, base class, create query, go ask for everything from the messages table. We need a method called add message, like this, that goes to the base class and says add object. Go to the table whose name is messages, go make a new message whose name is this and whose body is that, and then go save the changes. So this is all we need to add to the default base class here. This guy knows how to go into and out of tables. What we need to do is to tell him which table to look for and which object to put there. That's what we're doing here. All right? So now, going back to default aspects, we've got our storage account. We make a new data service context for going into and out of. And now here, context.addMessage. Here's the name that was typed in. Here's the message that was typed in. And right there, that adds it right there. That puts it into the table. So you see what I mean when I say, if you build these underlying classes correctly, the usage of them is, I mean, that's as close to trivial as you're going to get. Right? But you do need to build these underlying classes. You need to build this message class, which contains the data, the rows you're going to be adding to the table. And you need to create this context class, which is the mediation object that knows how to add things to and from the table. What you're basically doing here is adding strong typing on top of the general purpose class. It's, you know, not too hard. All right, so that's how we put it in. And now how do we display, you saw when we ran this, you saw how the messages came out underneath. How do we do that? Well, here, this.messageList, that's the main control that's on the web page, data source equals context.messages. Now remember again, this is our data context. Let's go see this message's property. Okay, I'll switch back to the data service context here. There. Here, this is a property that I wrote, messages. It says go to the base class, create a query, go look in the table whose name is this string, messages, and give back an iQueryable interface that holds that class, that holds the class message. All right? So really what I did here is I just took this string here, the string whose name is messages, and bound it to this class here, the class that is of class message that I wrote there. All right? So anyway, that's where that messages property came from. This piece here, context.messages right there, performs the query that you see right here. When I do a get, it does the query and back it comes. Now clearly, this is a very simplistic object. You know, if I had 5,000 messages, I would get all 5,000. That's probably more than I want. And there is any amount of fiddling that you can do here. You know, the maximum number to return, the minimum number to return, there's, you know, this query is incredibly rich. My point here is that the entry to this is pretty darn easy, it's pretty darn quick. All right? And that, I think, is what I have to say about the storage demonstrations. I'd like to thank you for coming along with me on this journey, beginning of our journey through cloud storage, and I hope I'll be seeing you again in some other go-round. Okay? Thanks. Good night.